New Balance recently announced the addition of All-American Cooper Flagg to the NB family, joining Cameron Brink and an elite player roster in the brand's mission of growing the game with the next generation of athletes. In part of New Balance's ongoing commitment to supporting athletes off the court, the Boston-based brand plans to work with Cooper on community initiatives in his home state of Maine. To shop the two-way V5, Hesse Low V2, and all New Balance basketball products, visit newbalance.com today.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
If you have a problem with it, build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, Billy King is here, former Sixers and Brooklyn Nets GM, NBA TV analyst. He's on radio. He's everywhere nowadays. Billy, what's going on? You have, as I see, you have a nice little pandemic office there you're working out of.
I do. I have a few things on the back. Actually, I'm seeing a picture behind me from my wing and two basketball legends there, Reggie Miller in it and Kyle Korver. But everybody's worked from home, so you get to see a little bit of how they live.
No Duke material there for you. I'm a little surprised by that.
There's a lot of Duke material. You're just not looking hard enough. There's always Duke material around. Actually, on my other show, it was Larry Brown. I saw that when he was coaching at Kansas, and I was mm-hmm. player Duke, so there you go.
You know what was fun watching? One of the fun parts about watching The Last Dance was watching that 98 conference finals with the Pacers and the Bulls there, and just how close that was, how much respect the Bulls had for that Pacers team, and, you know, just a shot or two, like, away from it going in a different direction.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's ironic, too, that Larry Brown and I, we had just left and got to Philadelphia. And so Larry Bird took over. They added Chris Mullin. And that group of guys, I think I tweeted it out. They were a group of guys that everybody knew their job, they knew their role, and they did it. And there was no bickering. People didn't care how many threes Reggie shot or what Chris Mullin did. They all did their job and did it well. And that's really the same thing as the Bulls. They didn't care what Dennis did, but Dennis went to play. Scottie did his job. And that's when you have a very, very good team, is that they – everybody just know their role and they do it well.
I did love the image of Bird on the sidelines after Reggie made the three in game six to put him up with like a second or so remaining, like not even a flinch from Larry Bird when that, I remember seeing that at the time, but you have a greater appreciation for like a player like Bird with literal ice in his veins that knows that a game ain't over until it's actually over.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think being on the bench with the Pacers earlier when I was with Reggie Miller and what he did against the Knicks at the guard and like that, ever since then when I was a coach, no matter what, the first thing I'd always do is look at the clock. Because in college, you know, if you had a game winner with 4 seconds, you know, you usually got a chance you're going to win the game. In the pros, if there's a half a second or a full second, you know they've got a chance. And having Michael Jordan on the other side, you know, you would be really, really concerned. Great point. The year Michael didn't play and we were playing at the stadium, Reggie hits a deep three, puts us up by two, and I think it was like 1.5 seconds left. Reggie takes a bow. He took four bows at the stadium in Chicago, they come over, then Tony Kukoc banks in a three and they win. And that right there told me all about the NBA. You've got to look at the clock. But you're right, Bird, his understanding of the moment and realizing it's not over, because one, they've got Michael Jordan, and two, there's time left.
What do you think we, you know, as someone that coached Reggie, like, would we look at him differently if he won a championship? I mean, how much more elevated would he be if he had won a title in those years?
Well, I think if they would have won that series and then got to the finals and won the championship, I think his status would be even higher, because one, they would have ended the Bulls run before that, you know, three-peat there in Michael's last year. But then to win a championship, he would have been elevated, because his heroics at the Garden are legendary. But to defeated Michael Jordan in Game 7 in Chicago and then to go on to win a championship, he would have been on another level.
I mean, championships are so strange, that how they get treated. I had this argument recently with Dan Patrick, who was – we were arguing about how Rick Barry was ranked ahead of Russell Westbrook, or ranked behind Russell Westbrook on ESPN's list. And it was more about, like, how good is Westbrook really? Like, if Oklahoma City had not choked away that Game 6 in 2016 and beaten Golden State and probably gone on to win the championship that year – I mean, Westbrook, we'd look at a lot differently, too. He wouldn't just be this numbers, you know, this numbers stuffer type of guy, this stat stuffer type of guy. We'd look at him as a winner. And it's just, in some ways, it is the difference in one game. Like, you don't get the job done in one game, and your entire career is viewed entirely differently.
No, you're right. And that was Michael before they won. Because, you know, when he was at Chicago, everybody said, well, he's a great scorer, but he hasn't won. And Michael even said that in the last dance. And then once he won that championship, then he'd be like, okay, he's another level. And in his mind, he said after he won, you know, two in a row, he thought about walking away. But but Larry and Magic had never won three in a row. So that drove him to be different. Then when he went to baseball, he came back, went three in a row. It puts him on a whole different level. And that's what everybody looks at LeBron. They'll say, well, LeBron, he won it in Miami. He won it in Cleveland. But, you know, Michael did it all in Chicago. But winning a championship, and you're right, one game – Patrick Ewing's tipping at the Garden Game 7 our first year in Indiana. He doesn't tip that in. We go to the finals, and, you know, maybe we beat Houston and win the championship. So it is amazing how a shot or one game defines a lot of players' careers.
And people that say Michael didn't have to leave like LeBron, I mean, obviously it's true. But, I mean, Michael in year three had, you know, that's when they picked up the greatest wingman in the history of basketball and Scottie Pippen. That same draft, they draft the power forward in Horace Grant that turned out to be the mainstay, the tough guy in that front court. Year five, he started working under the greatest coach in NBA history in Phil Jackson. So, I mean, it's not really fair. Like, he had things that LeBron didn't have early in his career. He had the stars. He had the great coaches. And if I don't believe for a second that if Jordan was in the same situation LeBron was, that he wouldn't have made the same type of decision. Maybe not on TV and televised like LeBron did, but I don't think Jordan would have stayed with Cleveland forever if they had that type of team around him.
Well, I think you're right. And I think with LeBron, like Jordan, they drafted Scottie. They drafted Horace Grant. And those guys developed. And Michael was still young when they drafted. It's almost like you talked about Oklahoma City when they had Westbrook. They had Durant. They drafted. They had
Harden there too, yeah.
Harden. So, you know, they drafted Ibaka. So they had a team that developed quickly, and they just couldn't keep it together. If they'd have kept Harden and kept Ibaka, you know, how good could they have been? And maybe Durant never leaves and he doesn't go to Golden State. But you're right. I think back then it wasn't the thing to do to just jump ship and go to another team because a lot of people didn't have the cap space. I think early on, when I first came to the league in 93 – there wasn't, it was like you had slots. So if a guy left, you had a slot to replace him. If a guy was making, you know, $800,000, you had a slot to replace $800,000. It wasn't this cap where you had to maneuver, you can get under the cap and do things like Pat Riley did to create the space. So I think a lot more people became much more cap savvy and made it so that people look at it. It's LeBron, when he went to the Lakers, he went there knowing that, hey, it may take some time. And the first year struggled. They had some caps where they were able to get a trade where Durant, I mean, AD goes there. So you're able to build a team a lot easier than nowadays than back then. Back then, you pretty much had to go through the draft.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like the only way they were able to get Dennis Rodman in Chicago was because they had that overpriced contract of Will Perdue. Like they could trade Will Perdue's $2 million for Rodman's two. Imagine $2 million being considered overpriced. It's like $2 million's like that's like go away money. That's like 10-day contracts nowadays in today's.
The people give we'll give you $2 million to take this guy.
It's like for you get $2 million, you get like 3 second-round picks or for those types of transactions. I'm curious your reaction to how Jerry Krause was portrayed in the documentary. I wrote this week that I thought he was done dirty in a lot of ways. And like I had one GM tell me recently that like this isn't a documentary, it's a movie, right? It's here's the villain in Krause, here's the hero in Jordan. It's got plenty of truth in it, but it's viewed through a certain prism. It's not done in a traditional documentary type of way. All that being said, I mean, I think there's people, Billy, that either knew little about Krause or nothing about Krause, that if they just watched that documentary, they came away thinking he was just a caretaker, which couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, the guy had plenty of warts to him, like, and made plenty of mistakes along the way. We can get into all that, but he did draft Pippen and Horace Grant. He did trade for Bill Cartwright. He did trade for Dennis Rodman. He did elevate Phil Jackson when Phil Jackson was nobody. Like, Phil Jackson was a CBA coach contemplating going into, like, the law at some point, you know, out in Albany. I mean, what was your take on that, and what was your perception in the 90s in the NBA, and I guess subsequently being around Jerry Krause as an executive?
Well, you know, they did portray him a certain way, and I think a lot of it, some statements that Jerry made, organization wins championships, Jerry said they didn't use the whole quote. And I think a lot of those guys used that as motivation to go out and play. When he drafted Kuko, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to show that this guy is not what Jerry Krause thinks. But I did like at the end when Scotty said, you know, I was fortunate to play with the best basketball player in the world, the best NBA coach, and best GM. I think Scotty did acknowledge that. And I think they all acknowledged the role that Jerry played there. And sometimes as management, you are the villain. Because you do have to trade guys. You do have to make decisions that aren't popular, but that's your job. Just as Michael was on the court, you know, that was Jerry's job to do, make tough decisions and do things. And, the movie, I think it portrayed facts, but it also could have portrayed a lot. It could have talked a lot about the great picks. Like picking Tony Kukoc where he did, even at, you know, they had to wait for him, was a great selection. Mm-hmm. To draft Scottie Pippen and, you know, to make the trade to get up to get him was another great move. Understanding what type of players they need to put around Michael for him to be successful. You know, they didn't have a lot of guys that were great scorers, but they had a lot of guys that fit their roles, and Scottie elevated to be an all-star, to go get Dennis Rodman at the right time. I think he made a lot of great moves. As a person, I enjoyed Jerry. We would have conversations. I'd call him, you know, trying to see if he was going to make moves or anything like that when we traded for Tony Kukoc. And whenever I would call Jerry, the beginning would be we'd be on the phone talking about fishing stories. He'd tell him about his fishing stories. He'd tell him about his grandkids. And we would talk, and then we'd get around the basketball, probably the latter part of it. For me, that was the enjoyable part of the job. Talking to a Jerry Krause and learning about him as a person, what he did away from the court, talking to a Jerry West. You didn't get that. When I went to Brooklyn, you start getting texts, would you do this? And I was like, well, wait a minute. We call and we talk for 30 minutes but now it's, you know, would you make this trade? No. Okay. What about this? And that was the translation. But Jerry was, and when you saw him in the gym, Jerry would say hi, but he was on a mission. He'd get to his seat somewhere where be him and his staff away from everybody, and he was going to focus on watching guys and talking to staff, and he didn't want anybody interrupting that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the better scouts of his generation, like certainly was a committed guy to scouting. And, you know, my you know, sort of 10,000-foot, you know, understanding of the initial kind of friction between Jordan and Krause was, like, Krause told him in 85, like, you can't play with a broken foot or with a bad foot. Like, we've got to... which is like the GM's job. Now, again, you can argue with the delivery of it, which I think Michael took some exception to, where, you know, Krause is effectively treating him like property. And if you're a player like Michael Jordan, you can't agree to that. And the Kukoc stuff. Now, Krause could have maybe toned down the fawning over Tony Kukoc over the years. Didn't have to, you know, lavish praise on a playmaking forward when he had a playmaking forward already there in Chicago. But those, you can't argue with the calls, can you? Like, Michael, year two, bad foot. Doctor says back then you may permanently injure yourself. Shut up. Don't play. Kukoc available with in the second round, a player of that caliber. Like, he got Kukoc before everybody in his position started like hunting the Tony Kukocs of the world, like wanted them. So I just don't think, I feel like the genesis of the friction, it was just ham-handedly handled. Like, Jerry made the right decisions, but he could have handled them and done them in a more player-sensitive way.
Yeah, and that's, I think, where the job is now. It's understanding players and getting them to understand your thought process. And I think back then it was, you know, we're management, you're players, and you just play. And I think as players' salaries rose and their stature in the league rose, you couldn't just do that anymore. I know with Allen at times, when Allen Iverson, when he'd say he'd be hurt and he couldn't play, you know, we would hide his jersey. He wouldn't bring it to the arena because if his jersey was there, he'd want to get it. One time, I think we were playing at the Garden, he was hurting, his jersey was there, and he said, we don't have any shoes. He said, he's looking around, hey, what size shoe you wear? You're not going to play, let me use your shoes. Or he tried to send a ball boy to the Foot Locker and just get a pair of, give me a pair of Iversons off the shelf. And so there are times, and at that moment, the player is mad, and I always used to try to follow it up with conversation, where he'd understand why we were doing it. Because you didn't want it to linger. And I think back then, because I knew Bob Ferry when he was general manager of the Bullets, they just made decisions. And there wasn't a lot of interaction, players and coaches, GMs and coaches as today. It was more coach dealt with the players, the GM made decisions, and GM usually weren't around to talk to the players. I think nowadays you've got to be available, you got to talk to them. And that was the difference in Kraus. I think nowadays, GMs would do a much better job that rookie year of getting to know Michael understand them, and engaging him in the process of building a team and going forward, so that when you do have to make a tough decision, they have trust and belief in you.
Yeah, you definitely have to build a relationship from day one, no question about that. Two aspects of the documentary that strained belief to me. One was, the poison pizza story. I mean, come on. Like, first it was the flu game. Then it was it the hangover game? And now it's the poison pizza game. I don't know if you saw the pizza guy apparently called the radio station in Utah. I listened to the interview. He basically called bullshit on everything that Michael and Tim Grover and those guys were saying in the documentary. And I'll tell you what, Billy, there's just no way. Like, there's no way that you make a call to a pizza place at 10:30, like, you're not going to say, can you deliver a pizza to Michael Jordan? Like, that's not going to happen. Moreover, not to disparage pizza makers of America, but I can't fathom them being chemists, that they can figure out, like, what to put on the pizza that'll make Michael Jordan just sick enough to maybe not be able to play the next day. I mean, I don't believe that. I don't know why. Like, I don't know why it's so hard to come clean with this stuff. Like, you know, one thing that was seemingly verified from the interview with that pizza guy was that Michael was in his room. Like, so he wasn't in Vegas or, doing whatever. And I mean, if he had a hangover, like, that would have been some serious drinking in your hotel room by yourself. But I don't, like, that to me, when I heard that story, I was like, come on, like, that can't be real. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it was something, because it was new. It was something that everybody thought it was the flu. And maybe it was food poisoning and just happened to be something that was bad in the pizza. And just, it wasn't something they, I think, maybe did on purpose. It could have just, because there are a lot of times where guys order room service and something comes in and then just maybe something in the fridge that the ingredient could have been bad and they ate it. At 10:30, maybe they were closing and, something they were throwing away, didn't realize and put it on the pizza and served it. But the only, where I was questioning it was, like you said, how do they know that he said this pizza's from Michael Jordan? So to me, it's like, it could have been going to Steve Kerr or somebody else if he's just going to the hotel. So that to me is where I just, but it could have been food poisoning. I don't know if it was intentional.
It could have been, I guess, but I mean, God, nobody's eaten more pizza than me over the last two decades, and I have never gotten sick from eating a pizza. And like Tim Grover had a book that came out a couple of years ago, and he did countless interviews for that book. And I'm sure during those interviews, he was asked something about the flu game or whatever. Like, this never came up. Like, this, like, Grover, like, and this isn't some, like, you know, story that you need to keep close to the vest. It's about a pizza. And, yeah. And I guess if you're around Michael Jordan, you have to protect all the secrets, no matter how innocuous they are. But, like, that to me was surprising. Like, why didn't that come up before now? Why is it now pizza and not flu or something maybe he picked up, you know, a day earlier that just kind of manifested itself in the next day in Utah? I mean, that was just weird.
Yeah, that to me, yeah, I don't doubt the food poisoning. I just don't know if it was intentional.
Yeah, I agree with that part of it. The more significant ending to that, or interesting note in that that documentary at the end, you know, Jordan remains this day convinced that they could have brought the band back together and won championship number 7. Now, my take on it, Billy, is that there's no way that band was getting back together. Like, you have Scottie Pippen, who throughout the entire documentary, you note that he's pissed off about his money, like wants to get paid. The idea that Scottie Pippen was going to come back on a one-year deal when he had $75 million on the table from Houston, nonsense to me. Not when he knows his body and he knows it's breaking down. Similarly, Steve Kerr and Luke Longley both got the richest contracts of their careers after that season. Now, if it had been like championship number 10, and like you could join like the Russells and Cousies and whatever, but there really isn't much special to number 7. It really is mostly special just to Michael Jordan. So I'm not sure what you thought at the time, like about the logistics of it, but I never believed, regardless of what you think about, if they came back, would they even be the best team in basketball? I mean, obviously Rodman was towards the end at that point. Pippen was banged up. Longley wasn't the same player. But at the time, did you think that team was improperly broken up and should have been kept together for one more year?
Well, the one thing, I would not have been cross and said this is going to be his last year, regardless if he was 82-0. Because by saying that, then you had no chance of bringing them back together. Because it was, you know, Phil wasn't, you know, I would have gone into it and said, look, we're all going into it. And at the end of the year, we'll sit down and talk and see if we can bring this together. It would have been, I think, pieces of it probably would not have been, or the pressure that would have been put on the Bulls. If Phil said, yes, I'm coming, I'll come back for a year. Michael, I'll come back for a year. Then the pressure would have been put on Reinsdorf, because if you got Phil Jackson agreeing to come back, Michael agreeing to come back, now, do you not give Scottie Pippen that $75 million contract? Do you not? Maybe Kerr you don't bring back. Maybe, but the thing about it is, I think it'd have been tough for Reinsdorf for them to say, okay, we got Michael back, Phil back. We're not going to pay Scottie and let him go, because then that may have caused Michael them to leave. And then it'd have been on Reinsdorf. So it may have been in Jerry's mind by saying it, he's never coming back, knowing that that will force the breakup, because, you know, knowing Phil, he wouldn't want to come back. And I think in Phil's mind, he probably knew it would have been pretty hard to put the group back together and to go back and try to beat the Pacers again, because, you know, the next year Indiana does get to the finals. And so looking at it, Phil probably said, I don't know if we can duplicate what we just did. It's probably best to walk away at this point in time.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I look at the players and what they were, and maybe Rodman would have been better with that group and with that coach, but he only played 35 games over the next 2 years. Like, he was effectively done after he left Chicago. Pippen flamed out pretty quickly in Houston, you know, had some decent years towards the end of Portland, whatever, but he was never the same player. Longley was never the same player. I mean, I look at Krause's original sin here. You know, you're right about the whole, don't say you're not coming back. Like, don't take a team that just won two championships and say, even if you win a third, it doesn't matter. You're not coming back. That's nonsense. But his greater sin is not, like, if he had broken up that team and then rebuilt it into a winner, we'd be talking about Jerry Krause completely differently. The problem is he broke up that team, and under his stewardship, they never achieved anything ever again.
Yeah, well, because I think that, as great as his finding of Scottie Pippen, I think he reached a little bit with the Griffin and the Chandler right out of high school, because they had Elton Brand. Mm-hmm. Trading him to get those two high school players. And at times as scouts, you think, okay, if these guys, we're going to project them out, rather than going to college in 3 years, they'll be, you know, if they were in college in 3 years, they'll be one or two. So, you know, but I always say once you give guys money, you never know how they are going to become as players. You know, is that same worth ethic going to be there, especially as young guys? But that, you're right. If he would have been able to redo it, you know, it's almost like, you know, Bill Belichick. If he's able to go do it again this year without Brady and win again, and maybe not this year, but in 2 or 3 years, then it's like, you know, hats off to him, because, you know, that's an incredible run to be able to do that. But very few teams, once you have that great run, San Antonio had a great run, it's hard now to put it back together, because what Chicago had when they started, they had Michael when he was young, Scotty, all those guys young, and so they grew up together, and so when they knew each other, they knew the culture. When you bring new people in and try to recreate that culture, you don't know, you need that leader. And Chicago never had that leader that made everybody follow. San Antonio, that Tim Duncan, they don't have that Tim Duncan where everybody, whatever Pop says, they're going to echo and do. And that to me, like in Philadelphia, when we made it to the finals with Allen and Eric Snow, Aaron McKee, Dikembe, you know, I knew that was a magical year. I knew that there's no way that same thing constructed could get back to the finals. So we traded Tyrone Hale and started to sort of put ourselves in position to start retooling and rebuilding, because I just knew that team itself wasn't going to be able to have another magical run.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing for a GM to do, at least from my perspective, is to be early on decisions. Like, yeah. It's almost easier to – and look, in the 1990s you had, you know, the Bulls had watched Boston do just that, kind of sort of decompose, you know, internally, and then go into a rebuilding process that looked like it was never going to end. I mean, they were so bad in the mid-1990s. And like that, if you see that, if that there's some recency to that, you that's got to be daunting if you're
yeah, there. But you got to look at Boston, and there was two players that they lost that really affected them more than anything, Lynn Bias and Reggie Lewis. I think if those two players were to live and continue to play, I don't think that slide would have been as tough. Probably the interesting team that's current now we're watching at is Dallas, is because they won their championship. Mark didn't bring anybody back, and they went, you know, they had Dirk to the end, and all of a sudden now there's a Luka, you know, they get Porzingis, and now are they on that next trajectory back to winning a championship? That would be Donnie Nelson. So it'll be interesting to see if they can be one of the first teams to do that. You know, Miami did it with Wade, brought in a couple guys and won, but now they're trying that same thing. Now they're trying to rebuild it. But I think Dallas is probably the closest to a team that can they do it. The Lakers won with Shaq, won with Gasol, but the constant was Kobe. So I think it goes back to my point. If Michael was willing to stay and keep playing and Phil kept coaching, yeah, they probably could have won a championship in 2 or 3 years with the pieces, because you had a great player in Michael.
Yeah, yeah, you could have rebuilt without rebuilding as long as those two guys were still around. Couple of questions for you on where we are right now. I mean, you talk to people throughout the league and you see what's going on. I mean, what's your level of confidence that we will see basketball before the end of the season? And Billy, I don't even want to – like, I was talking to a couple people this week, like – I don't even want to call it like a continuation of the season. It's not. It's a new season. Like, everything is new. Like, Bojan Bogdanovic is now out for the rest of the year in Utah. Like, Ben Simmons is back in Philadelphia. Like, this feels – you can't – it's going to be called a continuation, and a champion, if there is one, will be called the 19-20 champion. But it just doesn't feel like that's what it will actually be.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. Like, you look at Bojan having surgery – that was, I think, the dilemma for him is, how long is this going to take to finish this season? Then I have surgery. When is the next season going to start? Will I be ready to come back in time? And I think he had to make that decision based on his career to be ready for next season, not knowing what the uncertainty of this season. And that, to me, is the biggest concern, is all the uncertainty. Financially, it's going to be a hit no matter what. But the security, the uncertainty of playing – and I know, Adam, they said if one guy gets sick, then they'll isolate him. But if he just played, you know, say they played 3 games in 5 nights and all of a sudden he gets sick. Now there's 2 other teams you got to test. And what if 2 or 3 of those guys test positive? I mean, then is it going to affect the other guys, like saying, wait a minute, I don't want to play? I worry that there's just too many variables going into it that you don't know. Even in 2 weeks when Adam's going to make his decision, there's not going to be enough answers to give, you know, to say, okay, it's safe, we're going to do it, and it's going to work. Baseball, you know, it's outdoors. There's not as direct contact. Football is a lot further away when they can play. I just worry about the NBA trying to force it and looking at the financials and say, we got to do this for the financial. I'd much rather them sit down with the union and say, look, we may have to scrap this. Let's figure out a way that we can salvage the cap, set a number that's reasonable. Let's figure out how we can make sure that guys can make money, but owners aren't losing much money. And let's solve it. Let's get ready to set next season start. Maybe we push next season back to November, because the problem is as you go in the next summer, when you get to that flu season, everybody gets their flu shots, but players are going to be sick and then they're going to get tested. So I just think that there are just too many unanswered questions for them to try to say, we're going to force this down because of the financial hit that we're going to take. A lot of these owners are businessmen, and they look at it and they have business that they just write off debt and say, okay, it was a bad year, we're going to write it off, let's move forward and correct it down the road. To try to force this issue just because TV may want it, I think it could be – what you don't want to do is make a decision now to save this season and affect next season because then you're affecting two full seasons, or and then you have a bigger financial hit. So to me, I would – lean to just saying, you know, we're going to cancel the season, let the players that need get surgery, maybe push the draft back to July, free agency back to August 1st, and let's get the offseason going. Because even if you try to come back for regular season games, what's the incentive for Golden State if they got, 17 games, 15 games left to play? They're out of it. Mm-hmm. So what's the incentive for Steph Curry to go out there and play in these 15 games, even though he is under contract? God forbid he gets hurt in one of those games. Now he's out next season. Or Draymond Green. You know, these guys are going to say, wait a minute, I'm coming back to play. I know I'm under contract, but we're not making the playoffs. I mean, so maybe you just start where you just go playoffs right away. And then, okay, the teams want to make the playoff, they play. But I just think you can't make decisions that are going to affect next season. There's just too much uncertainty out there. It's like right now, they're going to open restaurants pretty soon. I don't see a lot of people running to go sit at a restaurant and to eat food and just to be there. I mean, there'll be some young people that say, I want to do it, but I don't think people are rushing to get back there. So that's what worries me about the NBA. NASCAR, yeah, they can get in the car and drive. It's, you know, but basketball, it's a contact sport. You go back to when Magic Johnson tested positive for HIV and the players were, the concerns they had there with the blood and everything, and we didn't know much about the HIV at that point in time. And then when Magic came back, he still felt that there was still the stigma out there, and when he finally walked away. This to me is even worse, because it's not a cut where blood is transferred. It could just be through the eyes or a guy cough. And these guys are very close. So a long answer. I just think there's just too much uncertainty for them to make a decision to continue to play. I know Adam is doing everything he can. So when he does make a decision, he can say, this is everything we did to make this decision. But I just worry that it's, you know, and it's not just the players. You're talking referees who are older. You're talking coaches. You're talking trainers. There's a lot more people that are involved in this. And if you're not doing it in a control environment, and if you're going to do it in a control environment, Vegas or Orlando, okay, you're going to put them in a bubble, a campus, and say, okay, just stay on this campus. Well, if they're all in Orlando or in Vegas, where do you think all these people that adore these guys, they're going to fly there, they're going to try to get around them? And it just, I think you're just creating enough a situation that you can make worse.
Yeah, no, those are all great points. And one, as I'm listening to you, one that, you know, I think is going to become a bigger one is, you know, talking to the union. Because if you decide to come back this year, you know, that sort of tables the conversation about next year, which I think is a bigger conversation with the union, because then you're talking about, you know, potentially an 82 game season that's done a quarter or a half or whatever without fans. And that's a pretty contentious conversation for how much money players are going to make. And we're starting to see signs of it with baseball. Like baseball players are balking at any kind of rev share or reduction in salary, which, you know, as we sit here speaking, I think it's going to really jeopardize the baseball season. I don't think they're going to get a deal done the next couple of weeks or months to And that's something, Billy, that they're that, you know, I know Michelle Roberts and Adam Silver have a great relationship or a really good relationship, but that's a fight that I think is coming down the pike.
Well, but I think the baseball one, there's a bigger issue there because their collective bargaining expires after next baseball season.
Yeah.
And I think the players don't want to get involved in any revenue sharing because they know that opens up the door to be revenue sharing into the next collective bargaining.
And basically a salary cap. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're sitting there saying, we don't want any part of revenue sharing because it gives them an avenue to show, hey, see this work, we can continue this on. So I think that's more of the issue for them than just playing and giving up money right now. I think they're looking at their negotiation coming up down the road. But for the union and the NBA, I think you're right, though, because that's why I think if you cancel this season, do everything you can to try to do it, but if you end up canceling, then you've got to really sit down and have some serious discussions about where things are going to go revenue-wise going forward, because it's going to be and I think the owners have opt-out in this that they push back. So it could lead to that where the owners say, okay, fine, they don't want to agree to any numbers we want to agree to, we'll just opt out and start all over again because they've got the TV deal locked in place. So it's going to be a bigger discussion going forward, I think, especially if they don't play this season. But I think even if they do play, because the cap's going to take a hit and they're going to want to try to smooth it out so it don't take as big a hit. So I think you're going to have some owners saying, if they don't want to do this, let's just opt out of it and we'll start over. And that's where it's interesting, Michelle, they were looking for a replacement. Now they're not because they want her to ride this out. And I think she should because she's been in the driver's seat from the beginning. But everybody's talking safety, but if it's baseball, it's basketball, it's coming down to revenue. It's coming down to economics at the end of the day. It's all about economics. That's the whole thing about this pandemic right now, reopening. It's about economics because at the end of the day, money's driving all this opening up, all the rules that we put out, that the president put out that we had to follow to open. No, they open up because they know they need, everybody knows we got to get the country back for the economic part of it. And I think that's the same thing with basketball. I think same thing with baseball. It is safety first, but it's going to come down to economics real soon with the NBA, whether they play or don't play, because the numbers are going to take a hit either way.
Yeah, I agree with all that. It always comes down to money, and that's where it's going to stop ultimately with basketball. The other part of it is, you know, there was momentum for starting the season around Christmas time anyway. You know, we know the Steve Koonin pitch, which I'm sure you'd heard before, and others have had this type of feeling that, you know, it's better for basketball's health to get away from football, start around Christmas, and play into July, August. You know, pandemic aside, what were your thoughts on that when you first heard it? I mean, are you a believer that the summer basketball makes sense? Do you prefer the schedule as is? What were your thoughts on it?
I'm not a big believer of summer basketball just because I think that, you know, if you look at college basketball, you know, everybody gets up for March Madness, April. And then, you know, once March Madness ends, it goes into Masters. And then you got the golf, you know, you got the U.S. Open. You got different things that people – then once you get to June, people are going to the beach. And so, you know, in New York City, for example, a lot of the people are going out east to buy tickets for the Garden, the Madison Square Garden. And Boston, they're going to the Cape. They're going to the Vineyard. And so now you're going to play basketball games, you know, NBA Finals in late July. Are people going to be saying, okay, you know what, I'm going to make sure I go back? No, they may watch it on TV. But I just think that, you know, college basketball has some great games in November. You know, Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, they play early. And it's just part of it. When I was in Philadelphia, we just made sure we avoided the Eagles as much as possible. When we put the dates in there, our building was available, I would say, we'll play either Sunday or Monday, whichever the Eagles aren't playing. Then once the football schedule came out, Matt Winnick would say, okay, the Eagles are playing Mondays, you're going to play Sunday. You're not going to run away from it. I think, you know, football, the Super Bowl now, it goes on. I think it goes till February. And so you're going to run up to it then. And what I worry is more in the summertime, just because people are ingrained of doing, they're going to the beach, they're doing, you know, kids are baseball. During the winter, you know, in November, and that's part of basketball. I think what the problem is there's so many games on, there's no reason to go to a game because you can get it on the league pass, or every game's on TV, and the ticket prices have gotten to the point where it's much easier just to watch it on TV. So I don't worry as much about, I think you got to fix the game itself. I think the game has become shoot as many threes, you know, 130, 150. It's great, it's up and down, but it's not a compelling, like, okay, they got to get a stop this possession. If there's 30 seconds, teams think, okay, if they score, we got timeout, we're going to get another score. So, you know, and to me, I think the team like Chicago, you're watching those games, Chicago, when they're winning last night, they're winning game 90 to 85, and they were great games because you had every possession mattered. I don't think every possession matters in an NBA game anymore. So it's hard for fans to stay engaged because my son, who's 12, he'll watch it and watch YouTube on his phone and look up for maybe the big plays because every possession doesn't matter. And that, to me, that's where you got to get back where the game matters, the possession matters. Fix the game, the product, and I think people will tune in more.
Oh, that's a good point because I'm watching the documentary and watching old Jordan highlights, and like coaches today wouldn't allow him to shoot like that. Like the low percentage baseline fadeaway that Jordan was known for, like he'd get chastised for that nowadays. Mid-range jumpers are like, I mean, they're grounds for benching at this point. Like it's all.
Yeah, I mean, when I came into coaching in NBA 93, I mean, it was you get to the hole, you know, got to get to the end. And where guys got to the foul line, Allen Iverson averaged over 30, but he shot, I think, 15 free throws. And then when when he was 80% free throw shooter, he averaged over 30. And it wasn't these ticky-tack fouls. It was going to the hole and guys knock him on his butt, get two free throws. Nowadays, I think it's, you know, guys just space out and the guy try to drive kick it, shoot a three. But you're right, though. The game has changed. But to me, and I may be an old school guy, I just think it's a compelling game because every possession matters. If you watch college basketball, no March Madness, every possession matters in college basketball when they're coming down. They're not, you know, guys running in their score. It's a big deal because, you know, you may not get that easy shot again. And they do, some teams do shoot a lot of threes, but it is a game where, you know, they grind it out a little more. I know the NBA back then thought the games were too slow. People didn't like it. So now the pendulum has swung so much now where you look at some scores, it's 140 to 150 and it's not, it's fun to watch, but it's not that appealing to me. I enjoyed watching Golden State because I thought they were very good. They shot out of threes, but they were a very good defensive team. Iguodala, Sean Livingston, Trey, they guarded you. Draymond, they guarded you, and then they shot the threes. There are a lot of teams now that still want to play that way, but they don't want to guard you on the other end. San Antonio, when they won the championship, they guarded you, and they scored. Miami, Pat Riley, even down there now, they look to guard you. They'll hit you, and they'll shoot some threes, but they're trying to guard you and limit your possession. Quinn Snyder, Utah, I mean, they're a very good defensive team. They've become a better scoring team, but they guard you.
Yeah. Got to mention the Duke guy at the end, of course.
Have you noticed Duke sort of is always weaved in and out? You know, when you're everywhere, it's hard not to.
Last question for you. Among the talking points for, things moving forward might be when to hold the draft. As a GM, would you prefer the draft to be the week before free agency as it is, or the week after, say, mid-July in a regular calendar?
You know, I've heard that debate back and forth, and I would like it afterwards. The only dilemma is potential trades if you're trying to create space. I think it would make it more compelling because people would be trying to move picks to create more space for that free agency at the beginning. But I do like it after for the fact because now because so much energy is put on that draft and all of a sudden you go right into free agency and, you know, you draft a guy and you're trading his rights. If you've already built your team through free agency, now you're focused on the draft. I don't think you'll see as many trades as much because I think people say, you know, you will see trades. People will be trying to get guys to fill holes that they didn't do in the free agency. I would like it to be afterwards. The one thing I like the draft that I wish NCAA allowed us to do is kids to go back to college if they get drafted. because if you get drafted, you don't like your selection, or you know, go back, and the team retain your rights until, I think, years. If you stay all 4 years, say you left after your freshman year and you got drafted, you went back, that team retains your rights until your senior year. So then you've got to stay in college, or you're going to still go to that team. If you come out of high school, you can get drafted, go play in college. Because on the pros, it's a risk. You're taking a kid now, he's going to go play college, and you're hoping he stays healthy. But that's one rule I like to change is let kids go back to college if they get drafted. Get drafted, go to college, and now they're not as worried about, I got to play. I think the college game would be better, and then they become better players. I do like the G League, letting kids come right on. I think you should let kids come right out of high school anyway and go right to the NBA. Because I think it's a sham to say, hey, you're going to go to college for one and done. That's the rules. Everybody's doing it. But I think it should be like baseball. If you go to college, you stay for 3 years. Or if you're going to go pro right away. But then also, if you're drafted, you can go back to college as well. So I put a lot of rules in there. But I think there's so much pressure on these kids to make a decision. I got to go pro. I got to pull my name out. And they don't have all the information. Let them stay in. If a team's willing to draft them, and they're willing to go back to college because they got to hope the school has a spot for them too. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't allow them to transfer if I was the NCAA. If you're going to go back to the school you left. But I wouldn't allow them to transfer once that decision is made.
Yeah, it's like the hockey formula where you get drafted, but you can go back in college hockey and do it that way. I think there's a lot of merit to that argument as well. Billy, always appreciate your time, man. Always learn something, and always great to talk to you, man. Hope you hang in there during this pandemic paradise as we head to these summer months.
You learn something, though?
I mean, sometimes, you know, okay. Periodically.
I try.
Thanks for doing this, Billy.
You're welcome. Take care.
New Balance recently announced the addition of All-American Cooper Flagg to the NB family, joining Cameron Brink and an elite player roster in the brand's mission of growing the game with the next generation of athletes. In part of New Balance's ongoing commitment to supporting athletes off the court, the Boston-based brand plans to work with Cooper on community initiatives in his home state of Maine. To shop the two-way V5, Hesse Low V2, and all New Balance basketball products, visit newbalance.com today.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.